Hello there and welcome to the No Script Show. In this episode, we're looking at inclusive design, what it is, why it matters, its core principles, and how we can apply them. You can find our show notes and resources at noscript.show/31. That's the numbers 31. And if you're watching this on YouTube, the link will be in the first comment just below the subscribe and like buttons. And as always, I'm joined by David. Hello, David. He's the one that does all the work. I just show up. Genuinely, I just show up and talk. He does all the hard work, makes the slides, does the research, thinks about everything, makes the website. So bravo, David.
Thank you. This one, hopefully this is going to be quick because we're just covering the five pillars of this website owner's manual, which I started doing, which is eagerly awaited by absolutely no one. But I'll bring it up actually for those who can see it on the YouTube, see if I can get my screen working. Okay, there. So yes, on this website owner's manual, in the preface of that, I've got these sort of standards, which is how we're going to build sites in the future. And it's got these five pillars. And we covered one last week, and we covered, which was content design, we covered the indie web, and today we're looking at exclusive design. And I've kind of put this one number one as the sort of priority, because I think it kind of sums up the whole concept of inclusive design, really the real unique strength of the web as a medium. So, you know, offline, if you wanted to reach everyone, there's a significant cost, you know, so if you have a physical location, you know, installing ramps or something for wheelchair access, or if you need translation services to account for other people's languages, or printing out some of your materials, you might have to do that in Braille. That's expensive. Online, and I think this is the real beauty of online, is that much of it is just kind of free, just for following a few standards. And I think, you know, it's good to get back to, I think, the basics here, because really for the last 30 odd, nearly 40 years, really the whole industry has kind of ignored this key thing about the web, is the fact that it can reach everybody and include everybody quite cheaply. So, you know, when we started with kind of table-based designs because we wanted things to look pretty, but that really threw out the ability for screen readers to be able to read the content that was there. And right through to now, we have many of the page builders that we're using really don't do a great job on kind of putting over the HTML in a way that it means that, you know, we can use services to translate it into other languages and that screen readers can read them and that kind of stuff. So I'm going to hand it back over to you after that long spiel.
I have a few comments about that. And the first one is that the legislation in the physical world kind of started to ramp up, to coin a phrase, quite a long time ago. And so, you know, you couldn't get away with it. So certainly in the UK, you know, things like accessibility for toilets and the capacity to get into a shop, you know, over the initial steps or whatever they may be, you have to put ramps in and lifts or elevators, those kind of things. And I suppose the curious thing about that is it's really obvious, because there you are in the physical world and you're about to enter the post office and there's somebody in a wheelchair that can't get into the post office, and you can see it. It's right there. You see the injustice of that situation before your eyes. The web, which is becoming an increasingly important part of everybody's lives, you know, with banking and tax filling and all of that, more or less required now online, nobody's standing over your shoulder. Most of the time you're doing it in the privacy of your own home. And even if they were sat next to you watching you browse the web, they wouldn't see the problems that you are having. You know, they might see the frustration on your face, but it's all very private, isn't it? And so I think this whole thing about 30 years on, the industry hasn't really caught up. I think it's basically because there's been no legislation, which is sort of changing. But B, because the inconvenience, it can be invisible. It can be not seen by anybody. So anyway, there's my two cents.
No, I think it's a really good point. And I think, you know, but it's even in with web standards themselves. I mean, they've not been particularly inclusive until recently. We've only recently have we really consider the other languages when we're writing the HTML, you know, the fact that we now are able to, in fact, we've rewritten CSS so it's no longer fixed to its dimensions, so we can actually do it, so we can code it. So if someone's using a right-to-left language or vertical language, the design can adapt to it. But that's a really very recent thing. Anyway, I will move on to the next slide, and I'll let you read out the main points on this, if I can do this side.
See if you can find it. Here we go. Okay, so here are some four bullet points related to inclusive design. Inclusive design is an approach that aims to make products, services, and content usable and welcoming for as many different people as possible across ages, backgrounds, abilities, and contexts. It goes beyond minimum accessibility compliance to actively look for who might be excluded and to remove or reduce those barriers. It assumes diversity as the default, not the edge case, and is an ongoing mindset, not a one-off checklist. It has been adopted by many global corporations, government bodies, and non-profits. I think the one that resonates most there for me is number three, but over to you, David, to give us your commentary.
Yeah. Well, I'll just take the last point, actually, about the fact that many global corporations and government bodies and non-profits take inclusive design seriously. And in a way, I think it's the kind of likes of you and I who, you know, have to make sites for clients who don't have the time to really do this kind of work that needs to be done on there. Because you'll find, you know, with big tech, there's Microsoft, they've published their principles as well. You can find that at inclusive.microsoft.design. Google has a process for it called product inclusion, and Apple, they've integrated accessibility features like voiceover and assistant touch tech technology directly into their operating system. So they're really on the ball, and they make a lot of money out of it. That's the reason why they're going to do it, isn't it? Because, you know, the more people you can reach, you know, the more money they are going to make. I think, you know, all of it really goes beyond exclusion. I think it's quite interesting when you think about sort of inclusive design and why it's sort of useful. Because if you just take this recording that we're doing at the moment, so YouTube is going to take our words and turn those into closed captions. It's going to literally read those. Now, that sort of benefit there might primarily be there for people who are deaf, but it's also going to help anybody who's in a noisy environment. It's going to help people with a temporary ear infection, and it might just help anybody who wants to listen to this without letting other people know that they are listening to us.
Very
as well.
Sensible.
Yeah, so I think, you know, a lot of this with the inclusive design is, well, there's a term, actually. We mentioned these before, gov.uk and their government digital services. They refer to this kind of inclusive as solve for one and extend to many. So, you know, if you put something in like those closed captions, not only does it benefit those people who would be excluded otherwise from it, but actually everybody gets those sort of benefits. You know, it's not something that's just for a particular fixed group of people who it helps with that.
I think the interesting thing from the little bit that you just said there is the three examples that you gave are these giant corporations that are swimming in excess cash. And so them being able to create these incredible technologies. So in the example of YouTube, you know, I mean, I don't even know what the turnover for that platform is, but it's eye-watering, I'm sure. That feels like such a brilliant cog that they can turn to make things available to people who, I don't know, are hard of hearing, let's go with that. And it probably costs them pennies per video. I mean, maybe in some situations, if they examined every video that they've got on there, the calculus doesn't work. You know, hardly anybody's looking at the closed captions and what have you. But like you said, solve for one, export to many, or whatever the phrase was.
Yeah.
It's amazing that those platforms can do that. But the burden for, I guess, for the audience for this podcast is people who don't have that excess of cash. You know, there's probably a bit of nickel and diming, you know, living from paycheck to paycheck, building websites, trying to trying to just make a living out of it. And so those calculations are a little bit more difficult to justify, you know, making everything accessible and doing that extra work. We're at that point where perhaps that's still being neglected because it takes that extra time and that extra expertise and so on. So there's not really any sort of question there or indeed insight, but it's just, I think, worth pointing out.
Yeah, no, and I think it's good. I didn't put this in the notes, so it just crossed my mind as you were saying it, is the fact that I do notice, because I'm still in kind of builder, page builder communities and stuff, that when a lot of accessibility law came out, there was a lot of people going, oh, God, it's just one more thing we have to do to abide by what the EU, because it's EU regulations that are coming out, particularly with Americans who use page builders. And I think really where I've got to is that that's exactly how I'd feel, like I've got to add in some extra work to the page builder stuff I've done to make it work. But now you're getting back to the basics again. You just think, well, if we'd have just done it properly in the first place with decent code, we wouldn't be in that situation at the moment. So, I think that's kind of where we're going with this. If you just build them with the right mindset, instead of just primarily being worried about what you see on the screen and think about what you're communicating in the code in the basic HTML, you know, there is so much to be gained by doing that. So
I guess if you're in the business of retrofitting things and that takes, I don't know, 2 days or 3 days or whatever it may be, that seems like a burden. But if each time you add some semantic element to the HTML, you do the 4 second addition at that moment, that burden is spread out over the entire build and you maybe would never notice it, in fact. That's interesting.
Let's I'll put on the next slide for you to read a little look at sort of the history. And I'm struggling with my slides. Here we go.
That's okay. Here we go. So this is the historical evolution. Shall I just read these into the record?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So this is fascinating, actually, and much of this I didn't know until I caught sight of this slide. So going back right to the 1950s, the 1950s to the 1960s, barrier-free design. So this was the idea of removing physical obstacles to help disabled World War II veterans. That's really interesting that the world was suddenly more full, let's say, with people who were struggling to move about, and so things started to happen because of that. And then we move on to the 1970s, the social model of disability. This was an era which challenged the medical model, which viewed disability as something to be cured. Instead, advocates argued that people are disabled by a society that fails to accommodate their needs. That is so profoundly interesting. Moving on to the 1980s, universal design. This aimed for a single one-size-fits-all solution that works for everybody without needing adaptation. And then the last point on this slide, 1990s onwards, so we're into the era of what we're talking about today, inclusive design. This acknowledges that multiple variations may need to be truly needed to truly include everybody. What a whole turning the ship scenario this is, like go one direction then go in another direction, but also the real world challenges that made that all possible. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think our modern world all starts from, you know, Second World War, where we people had kind of more than they ever had before in terms of, you know, democracy and things that are available to them. But yeah, I've got some notes. I'll just add some extra details. So the inclusive design was popularized by Roger Coleman and his colleagues at the Royal College of Art in the UK. And universal design came from the US. So that's going back to the 80s there, by an architect, product designer, and educator, Ron Mays, who coined that term there. And that's the one that I kind of, you know, that's the period that I grew up where was sort of, you know, that was the whole thing. You kind of made everything so it would work for everybody now. And I think where you get into the inclusive design is that earlier point that we mentioned, where we're saying that if you add one thing extra for a group of people, then everybody gets to benefit from it. So it's kind of that major shift there, I think. I mean, a lot of what we do is universal anyway, so it's But I just find that, anyway, I just put that slide in because I just thought it was interesting how we sort of gradually move forward. I mean, you could say at the moment while we're recording this, we've gone in the opposite direction where we're sort of might is right and we're less inclusive, I think, at the moment at this.
Well, but, the only thing I would add is that if you were to look at that slide in 100 years' time, there would no doubt be other bullet points that have been added, as the future will definitely be not the same as the present, for sure. There will be different interpretations and things tend to swing in different directions. But the hopefully the thread running through it is that, you know, the idea is that you make it easy for everybody given whatever situation they're in. But anyway, yeah.
And it just makes good. I mean, you know, even in a capitalist society, you would still expect, obviously, that's why Google and Microsoft and obviously are on board with this, because it actually kind of works. Anyway, I'll move on to the next slide for you to read out.
Okay, so this is, I suppose, getting to the underpinnings of what's the point, really. So why does it matter? Why it matters? Four bullet points here. Designing inclusively strengthens brands by making it easier for more people to find, use and trust what we offer. It also supports our ethical commitments, reduces legal and reputational risk. It often improves the experience for everybody, not just people with specific access needs. And you start with a competitive edge. 95% don't even manage basic accessibility. Gosh, there's a lot in there, isn't there? Some of it more moral, some of it more like, well, carrot and stick, let's put it that way. Some of it more moral and some of it more legal in nature.
Yeah. I mean, we covered before about the fact that, I mean, every time there's accessibility surveys done, they really come out with still in the sort of in the 90%. I mean, it starts to increase, but very basic accessibility is just not done, you know, and it is a case of nothing that's an extra cost. You know, it's simply just picking the right colors in the first place so everybody can see that and, you know, just marking things up as they should be marked up rather than just forgetting about it and just concentrating on the visuals. So the really easy fix to make, in short, really, I mean, the summary of this is it just makes better products and services. And, you know, if you're into that, it's going to make you more money for doing that. So,
you know, calculus is pretty straightforward, isn't it, when you look at it like that?
So, I mean, you know, we just only have to start with semantic accessible HTML in the first place. And we're going to, by default, we're going to get better SEO. We're going to reach more people. Let me just have a quick...
Well, you've got some downsides listed because we've only ever sort of mentioned the benefits here, haven't you? But, well, you haven't got downsides listed, but you were saying, are there downsides? This?
I mean, I don't think there are any downsides in other accommodating, apart from the fact that you might have to sort of start with some of the basics. I mean, one thing I suppose that I've put in my notes here is that accessibility experts are often reminding us that disability in some form or another touches nearly everybody's lives at some point, you know, so we are so used to the fact of thinking about accessibility of a group of disabled people who we have to accommodate and do all this extra work for. But in reality, it's not. And you kind of realize it as you get older. I'm noticing it all the time. Oh. You know, I have to enlarge my text so much more. And that means that somebody needed to design their website so I could enlarge it on my browser, you know. But people have accidents, you know, all the time. You had an operation, didn't you? So, affected you for some time. So it's just all those kind of things. And it's all the accessibility experts will like to point to the fact that there'll just be situational events where there may be a parent holding a child who only has one hand free to be able to manipulate the internet. So there will be needing to use tabbing. And so often, because we don't test in that way, we tend to just use our mouse on the way that we typically do. We don't test whether our tabbing order is correct on every page, you know, which can just throw somebody out. So
it's so interesting that and how obvious some of these problems are when you have that little, in my case, I've had a very straightforward life, let's put it that way. But I have these little moments where, like you said, you have a bit of surgery and for a period of time, normal is no longer normal and things are different. And you suddenly encounter all these problems, and the amount of tutting and kind of moral outrage that I would have, whereas before I would be completely oblivious to it, was fairly profound. And yeah, you suddenly notice, oh, that's why, is it? So yeah, but you're right. You know, you break an arm, you break a leg, you have to carry an object, you, I don't know, you're temporarily unwell. All of these things fall into this category. So it's not necessarily just for people who have conditions that are permanent, although I think the moral calculus is that they're probably the target audience.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't want to lose the fact that there is an important political group out there who needs to be voiced as well. But yeah, I mean, certainly we're all growing older as well, so it's more likely that we do need our internet to serve us better in that way. Do you know what? I was just thinking about this. I think I only ever once had a client who said to me on a page where I had a form that my tabbing order was all wrong. And and I just wonder, it was quite late into doing this because I obviously wasn't tested myself. So it just makes me wonder how many forms I created in the past where the tabbing was completely out until it took a client to tell me. Terrible,
well,
really.
So, and the curious problem there is that, and this is such a compounding problem, the capacity to report the problem is potentially through something like a form. So we're funneling people who have these problems into platforms which they have to overcome the very same problems in order to report the problems. You can sort of see where this is going. Mm. The infrastructure to report complaints is often the same infrastructure that they're complaining about.
Yes.
And can you imagine how frustrating that would be? I don't know, you want to report a form not working, but the form you need to use to report the form is also not working in that way. And on it goes. You can imagine that writ large across almost every aspect of the internet, you know, navigation to find the form that you need to fill out and yada, yada, on it goes. It's, that must be extremely infuriating. And I expect probably a lot of dead ends. You know, I mean, I find it very hard. Let's say, for example, I'm on my insurance website and I wish to cancel my policy. That is hard enough. Just being able to scan that with my eyes. I have no idea how somebody with a screen reader would finally navigate to that final button and go through the 9 different pages that you've got to figure out which button am I pressing, which is the correct one to proceed here. All of that must be just so unbelievably infuriating. Anyway, I will get off my pedestal now. That's my
that's my
thoughts on that.
I've got another slide for you.
Okay.
When I find it, there we go.
Core principles, I think, is what you're looking for. There we go.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's list out the 5 core principles. They are equity, flexibility, clarity, tolerance for error, and participation. Starting with equity, people with different abilities or contexts can complete key tasks with similar ease and dignity. Oh, that's an interesting last word, isn't it? Dignity. Wow. Flexibility, interfaces work with different input methods, preferences, and assistive technologies. Clarity, content and controls are simple, well-structured, and easy to perceive. For example, pleasant contrast, clear hierarchy, and plain language. Tolerance for error. The experience helps people to avoid mistakes and recover easily when they happen. And participation, finally. We seek feedback from a diverse range of users and iterate based on what we learn. Over to you.
Yeah, well, nothing to say on this. I mean, apart from the fact that, as you pointed out, that word dignity, it's a great word. Respect and dignity, I mean, for all. Imagine that today.
And it is the bedrock of so much, isn't it? You know, it's the sort of thing we carry around and often we don't show it, but it really is the basis of all sorts of levels of happiness. You know, if you don't feel that you have dignity, I think so much collapses on the inside. And we present this interface, the internet, where that dignity is just shattered over and over again, day in, day out, minute by minute. And it must be somewhat soul-destroying, you know, and this wonderful technology, which in theory could have enabled everything to happen, suddenly becomes shut off, frustrating, and that whole internet, oh, I'm just not bothering. And what a shame that is.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
I'm going to move on to the next slide. and leave it to you.
So here we're looking then at how website owners apply this. So I'll just read through them again. The way to apply this is, for example, to use concise language and explain jargon when it's unavoidable. Use meaningful headings, lists, and descriptive link text. Check actions can be completed with a keyboard and are announced to assistive technologies. Alt text for images that convey their purpose. Avoid relying on color and maintain sufficient color contrast. Choose imagery and examples that reflect a variety of people and situations without tokenism. Okay,
yeah.
Over to you.
Yeah, well, there's nothing new here. I guess we've probably talked about all of these things at some point. I think because obviously we're in a time where everybody, particularly with the EU law coming into effect last year, 2025, where if you're serving people in the EU, you have to abide, particularly if you're earning more than 2 million or you have 10 employees, you have to abide and bring things up to the work ethic standard. I think it's 2.1 or whatever. So everybody's kind of aware of this, but this is a bit more rounded than this one because there are a few things, you know, particularly the things that reflect in a variety of people without tokenism in those lists of things here. And things like language as well. These aren't covered in accessibility. And I think the interesting thing about that is the fact that also, what we're going to find is WCAG is changing as well. The set of rules which we have to apply presently, but they're moving towards a version 3 of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, for those who don't know what WCAG is, where it's going to be a little bit less rules-based. It's going to be about looking at the totality. That's it. Of the experience, if you like, rather than specific rules that you will break with it. So it's going to be quite a shift in that. So I think, you know, with all of this, I mean, I'm tempted to have a bit of a rant about AI, as I often am, but, you know.
I could see in the notes there was that you were definitely swerving in that direction. Yeah. Go on. Do it.
Well, it's just, I think I might do later. I put another note in there. I couldn't resist. Okay. But we sort of move towards that where, you know, we shouldn't be letting AI do our HTML. It's the thing, it's our content and how we mark it up and how we want it to be interpreted by us to other human beings. And I think, you know, that's really what we have to get back to with the inclusive design, where we're creating this for other people with respect and dignity. And I think this is always the thing that we're trying to get across with this over and above the legal things that we have to cover with accessibility. So, you know, I mean, I think it would also cover when we're looking at inclusive design, we'll be avoiding the thing that I think you were alluding to before with sort of dark patterns. You were talking about trying to cancel your insurance or something, and it might be 9 pages or something like that.
Right.
These are often purposeful dark patterns, aren't they, to prevent somebody doing what they wanted to do in order to keep them on longer and make more money out of them. So I think, you know, this is also included in this. It's something that we want to avoid all the time. Keep that kind of respect for people as we're doing stuff.
Yeah, you would hope that there would be some sort of self correction mechanism, but that doesn't seem to be the case. You know, companies employing these deceptive designs seem to thrive, unfortunately. I wish it were not the case. I wish that people would express their fury and these things would go away, but sadly it seems to be reasonably effective, so they keep them in. The worst of them is booking airline tickets. You've paid for your ticket, you think, and then like, what's going on here? You know, they've got this 17 pages of cars and insurance and hotels and confirmation of seats and all of this, and never quite know whether I've succeeded booking a ticket. Anyway, I digress, but yeah.
Yeah, but it's it's a real key thing because it's such short-term thinking, isn't it? Because you know, it works for a little while. People can't cancel things that they want to cancel, so you make more money. But in the long run, everybody gets so tired of it that, you know, you're kind of you're no longer considered a company that people want to deal with. Eventually, you might make a lot of money in the short term, but eventually, you know, it spoils it for everyone.
Well, and interestingly, despite the fact that the internet's been around for a while, we still are a bit of Wild West mentality, and it's still an emerging technology. So I know you've been able to book flights for a while. I also know that a lot of people still use the telephone and you know, contact a travel agent to avoid all of that kind of stuff. But what I'm trying to say is I think the jury's still out with this sort of stuff. Maybe in a decade, we really will have grown weary about them and things like the airline industry and the insurance industry and whichever industry is employing these deceptive designs. Maybe they will wake up to that and realize that quick buck is actually, you know, something that the longevity of the company into decades and, you know, multiple decades might be affected by that. But at the moment, profiteering seems to come before anything. But maybe that will change.
Yeah. I mean, there was another note that I put in here, because I think when you read through that list that you did first there about how you can apply it, and most people might look at that and go, well, that's just a list of things that come under accessibility. And I think probably one of the key things that the web industry seems to be learning at the moment is that about this particular medium is that the skill sets themselves can't work in silos. So we were talking last time about that being the point of content design, the fact that content isn't written first and then designed second, both have to happen at the same time. And I think that's the case with all of this design, that we're realizing that we kind of, all the skills need to come together. We need to work together. I mean, that's the whole thing about Agile as well, which we'll talk about as a separate thing. They all kind of interconnect, this idea that you work on an ongoing basis with multiple skills at the same time to constantly keep improving and making a website better. And I think this kind of fits into that whole thinking. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. That makes perfect sense. But again, time will tell.
It will. Let me move on to another slide, shall I?
Okay, sure.
And
we're on to designers, I think. Yeah. How a designer might apply this. I'll just read them through again. So inclusive design is about patterns. Most exclusion happens through common patterns, for example, navigation menus, dialogues, forms, carousels, etc., which are implemented badly. They start from semantics and HTML, not from visuals. Design for variance, not the average user. For example, hand injury, noisy train, cracked screen. Oh, cracked screen. That's an interesting one. Test with assistive tech and real people, and bake it into the process, not just audits at the end. That's the last one there, the number five. That's how I would have always handled it, just some sort of audit at the end. And like I alluded to earlier, or you alluded to, if it's like a 20-second task repeated hundreds of times, that feels much nicer than the three-day headache at the end where you've then got to go back and rebuild everything, which is probably going to take more like 6 days or 10 days. But that's quite a shift. That is quite a shift, getting into that pattern and undoing all of those other four things that you've got in front of you, especially when the tools that we're using, page builders in the WordPress space, for example, just drop this stuff in a handy one-click, you know, easy way to do it with no necessarily no way to understand how that's been implemented badly. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, last point, baking it into the process, and that's why I think it links in with Agile, and that's generally the way. I mean, we used to have a sort of waterfall process that we would follow, where we would have an idea, something would get signed off as a visual on our website, someone would go away, and then you would do a checklist to check everything's working, and then out it would go. Where Agile, we bring in a small group of different skills that keep the focus on what we're trying to do all the time, and we keep adding to incrementally improving the product that we're doing. And I think that's why this kind of links in with that. And we'll talk about that, I think, separately. But yeah, it's interesting because most of the things we don't even consider, like, you know, the cracked screen and stuff like that, where we're trying to think about all the different situations that someone could find themselves in trying to access the web, and think about them as we're going through the process. There is a good book, often mentioned, this fellow, Hayden Pickering. He's written
a book. Yeah, you do. He gets a lot of attention, doesn't he?
He does. Like, yeah, he's a really serious thinker on this. He's wrote a book, which I have, called Inclusive Components, and he walks through, for those on the technical side, some of the common UI patterns that you'll have. So accordions, menus, tooltip sliders, all that kind of stuff. It will talk about the code and about how you can do this in an inclusive manner, and try and make it as bulletproof as possible. In fact, one of the things is still unsolved, because there is no HTML for the card, you know, and we talk about cards all the time.
Yeah.
And we're always stuck with this. This is going off point, actually, a little bit, but I was just thinking about this again today. So we use cards so much, you know, they're often, you know, a little preview of a blog post or something like that, where there might be a heading, some text, an image, perhaps another link in there. And we want that whole thing to be clickable, because it seems obvious this whole card should be clickable. And obviously the wrong way to do it is to put it all in an A tag, so everything is there. Now, why that's wrong is because the A tag should just be containing the text and the link to it, not all of this other stuff with images and all this other stuff. So that's kind of the wrong way to do it. But the only other solution we've got is this sort of CSS hack at the moment, where we kind of put this overlay over the top of it. But also this, and Hayden doesn't solve this, by the way, it's still to be solved, this thing about the web. You can put an overlay on, so the whole thing, if you like, becomes clickable. But you can't select the individual text within that, which is something that you should be able to do. So there still is no good solution. There's a sort of a JavaScript hack for this kind of thing. So you can sort of delay it, so the JavaScript will, so you can select your text. And when you, anyways, it's a complex thing. But it's just really interesting that we're still at that point now, you know, what, nearly 40 years on since the web.
Yeah, we're still evolving. It's still an emerging technology. There are still bits, key bit like that, which need another look, basically.
Yeah. Okay. There are, I mean, I'll put them at the end there. There are some other links to some things as well, where you can kind of learn, if you like, how to start applying this. I think, actually, we are at the end. I'll move on.
I'll just quickly add that any links that are mentioned will go into the descriptions and, you know, what have you, on the NoScript show website. So if you go to noscript.show/31, the numbers 31, you'll be able to find the links there, and actually showing them on the screen, unclickable in a video. That would be nice. There's some links. You don't need those reading out, I'm guessing. Or do you?
No. I put them on for those who can see it. But yes, you're quite right. They'll be there. And the PDF that we're using there will also be online. And there'll be the clickable links on there. But there's a whole bunch of them. Things that we've mentioned before, which I think if you want to learn more about this topic, these are good resources there to get into it. And I think that's the kind of way the web is moving, at least at the top end. And I think the summary of the whole show really is the fact that it kind of costs less to do it right in the beginning. So, you know.
And I think the research also shows that it makes you more. Not only does it cost less to do it right at the beginning, but it makes you more in the end, curiously. So it's a bit of a, I hate to use the phrase, but it's a bit of a win-win.
Yes. I wonder, though, we're sort of fighting this, because it does seem, you know, obviously page builders, they were popular for a time, and now AI is really popular. And it's, you know, this idea that AI will be able to make our websites for us. And I'm really becoming much more adverse to this. You know, we should be creating websites for human beings all the time and not trusting AI. And there was a wonderful quote, and I just included this, that I saw.
It's lovely.
A guy. Yeah, Alex Wood, who's a software engineer and a bit of a tech writer. He's got a blog, and he said, letting an LLM write for you is like paying someone to work out for you. And I really
find that. Okay.
It's exactly that, isn't it? You sort of de-skill yourself, but also when you apply this to the web, it's almost like you're tripping other people over at the same time as
because it's a black box, isn't it? You don't look at the code, and with regret, dear listener, I think the code is the point. If you're going to build these sites correctly, you do need to get into the code and examine whether or not it's been implemented in the most accessible way. So, yeah, gosh.
And lovely HTML. Quote.
I love that.
Anyway, that brings us to the end. I don't know.
Okay. In which case, I will bid you adieu. Just one more reminder, noscript.show/3131 for the show notes and what have you. And we'll see you next time, David. Yeah, have a good day and see you soon.
Yeah. Bye. Bye.